Have you seen the well-to-do up on Lenox Avenue on that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air? High hats and colored collars, white hats and $15, spending every dime for a wonderful time. If you're blue, you don't know where to go to. Why don't you go where Harlan sits, putting on the Ritz?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Let's now talk about the economy in a broader sense, in the sense of the global economy, how it's affecting Wall Street, with L. Randall Reyes, Professor of Economics and Research Director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He also writes regularly for the websites Benziger.com, New Economic Perspectives, and New Deal 2.0. Welcome to Background Briefing, Randall Ray. And you're in New York, near Wall Street in Manhattan, at the Levi Institute. And let me following on from the last interview with somebody that knows Wall Street well, do you think this 513-point drop in the Dow today is a sign of letting off steam out of an overheated stock market, or is it, as I suggested, maybe Wall Street's saying to Washington, you know, you guys just took $2 trillion out of a sick economy, and it's just going to make things worse?
Well, I think probably there's a bit of both. I think the stock market has been in an unsustainable bubble, and it doesn't take much to cause some jitters and some sell-offs. But I think that you're right. With all the bad economic news that came out very recently, I think Wall Street started getting scared that all the focus has been on deficit cutting and there has been no focus on the real economy.
And do you think that message, surely, I mean, if the Wall Street people were watching these economic illiterates on Capitol Hill, the Tea Party types, threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States over the last month or weeks or so, and they weren't able to weigh in and stop it, presumably. I mean, they've got to be rational people. They have to understand that that was the stupidest thing you could possibly do. You're actually telling the world out there, don't buy our treasury bills. I mean, that's what's been going on. So in that context, do you think that these powerful Wall Street guys, and we know that a lot of people argue that Barack Obama sold his soul to Wall Street, surely somebody from Wall Street is saying, you know, you guys are digging the hole deeper. You're not bringing the economy out of the doldrums.
Yeah, I think there's a mixed message going on because certainly last week, the view on Wall Street was this is all political theater. These guys are going to come to a so-called compromise that actually everybody wants, and they're going to do the deal. I think that they might have gotten shaken a little bit that the deal wasn't closed last week. But I think they viewed it as political theater. And I listened to the last couple of minutes of your previous guest. And, I mean, he lives in a different world, obviously, a different universe. But that is the universe of Wall Street and the Washington Beltway, which is that you've got to get your fiscal house in order. I heard him say that, and you hear this all the time. And they believe that just somehow magically, if Congress can agree on some huge deficit cutting down the road some piece, then magically business is going to just get enthusiastic and run out and start spending even though they have no sales. People are losing their jobs. House prices are continuing to fall. That business is just a huge philanthropy, that they're all working for charity. It's bizarre.
Well, that's what I understand, is that, you know, that this economy will never get back on its feet unless there's employment and demand, which go hand in hand. I mean,
it's simple.
It's really simple. But so then you get to the question of, well, do they? Is this the new reality? I mean, is this you know, our step towards kind of an oligarchical America, where, you know, because the only people that, as far as I can tell, you know, they talk about we've recovered from the recession. Well, the people who've recovered are the people at the top, the very people who were rewarded over these last two decades, who crashed the economy and then got rewarded again. And now they're back on top, but the mess that they caused continues, and everything that the Washington has done recently is going to continue the pain for the many while continuing to reward the few.
Yeah, there was a recent very good study that showed that since the so-called recovery began, of the growth of national income that has occurred since the bottom of the recession, workers got 1%. Take all American workers together, they got 1% of the increase of national income. Corporate profits got 88%. And a huge part of that went right back to Wall Street. Wall Street got 40% of all corporate profits. And so, yeah, we're rewarding the people that caused the collapse. They're doing just fine. And as your previous guest said, they're just sitting on the profits. And this idea that they're going to run out and start spending those is just crazy, but they appear to have, Wall Street at least, appears to have convinced itself that this is true.
So they've, I keep talking about smooth hauling, and we're going to have a historian on in a little while to talk about it. Because, you know, looking back, and it's pretty hard to, I mean, I don't know what Bernanke thinks about what's going on, but he's apparently a student of the Depression. And it just feels like with all of these indicators out there, with what's happening in Europe, with these prominent people now, you can say, well, if Bill Gross at PIMCO, you know, he's got a bias towards bonds. But if he's saying the entire economy looks like an airplane that's about to stall, and if Meredith Whitney, who's the big guru on municipal bonds, saying that we are in a double dip, and furthermore, there's going to be a cascading of municipal defaults, and that seems to be fairly clear because the stimulus money ran out for the states, and they're starting to lay off, and, you know, we're going to have no police, no fire, no libraries, and here in the state of California, you can't even go to a court anymore. You know, it's all happening, and it all feels to me like this is the third worldization, if you will, of the United States. And the last time the United States was a third world country was during the Depression.
Well, it's funny you should mention that because this looks an awful lot like 1937, but in a lot of ways worse. Roosevelt started tightening fiscal policy for about 6 months, and we crashed in 1937. Most Americans don't know that that crash was much steeper than the crash that came in 1929 after the stock market crash. The economy just absolutely collapsed when they tightened fiscal policy, thinking that they had recovered. And the reason I say that it's worse this time is because just think about what they had done in the 30s. They put the New Deal programs into place. They closed down the most insolvent banks. They actually had started reforming the financial system. We've done none of that. We don't have any New Deal programs. We've been getting rid of them. We didn't reform Wall Street. We let them continue doing what they were doing. We bailed them out. But then we let them continue doing exactly what they did in 2007 that caused the crash. So in a lot of ways, yeah, it looks like we didn't even have the recovery that you had in the U.S. from 33 to 37, thanks to the Roosevelt New Deal. We had a very weak recovery that didn't improve the situation of most Americans, and now we're going to collapse.
So you're on the side of those that think that you can connect the dots out there, and that when these people on Wall Street like Alan Sinai have said that have made the analogy with the lost decade in Japan, that after the real estate boom burst in Japan in the 1990s, a whole decade of stagnation, which arguably is still going on, followed. So is that an analogy? You think that the economy really hasn't recovered from the 2008 crash, except the people who caused it, they've all recovered. But does this inevitably mean a lost decade for us? Is that the cause, if you will, you know, the original sin of our current economic distress?
Well, I think we could trace the distress back even further. I might go back to the Carter years. We have not recovered. I don't think we are going to have a lost decade like Japan's. And let me just say why. Japan was an exporting country, and it relies on the rest of the world. And yes, it had a downturn, and it has had very weak growth ever since, but still it is relying more or less on the United States and Asian countries to help prop it up, so that things are bad, but they don't go to 1930s-style depression. Now, the United States is in a very different situation. We can't rely on the rest of the world to prop us up. If we go down, we take the whole world with us. So I would say the scenario is going to be a much steeper decline, much worse situation than what Japan has seen. And we will not be able to tolerate 10 years of that. So I don't see a 10-year-long depression.
So what do you see, though? Because it seems to me that politically, the only people in this country have political energy are on the far right. There's no energy on the left. There's a lot of disillusionment. The far right are economic illiterates, as we can see from what they were threatening recently. But they play hardball. But it has consequences. And a lot of them are driven by libertarian ideas that you just have to destroy the government. We don't need a government. Private enterprise will run it, you know, run the world magically, and we'll all have prosperity. I mean, Jack Kennedy said, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. The tide is not rising. The gulf between the rich and the poor is growing. This is all lunacy and fantasy. The reality is the country seems to be heading, here in California, we're not going to be able to get our day in court. Libraries are closing. These are a series of canaries in the minefield. And I'm not trying to be Chicken Little here. I'm just saying that I think somebody has to connect the dots.
Yeah, I think there are two ways of looking at this. One is that we've got the far right, and they're pushing very hard. They want to dismantle all the New Deal reforms, the safety nets. And that on the other side, we've got the Democrats who are fighting against this. We have Obama in the middle. He had to make a grand compromise. He got the best deal he could in the circumstances. Okay, it's a plausible scenario. Maybe that is what is going on, and we need to rally the Democrats and try to protect what we can, but we realize we're going to lose a lot. Okay, the other possible scenario is, and we talked about this in April when I was last on, I believe, shock doctrine. It could be that this wasn't a compromise at all. It was a foregone conclusion. There was political theater, a smokescreen to hide the fact that the Democrats and Republicans and Obama are working together to get the results they want, which is they want to eliminate the social safety net. And it is looking more and more like that is the reality. Boehner is out there bragging he got 98% of what he wanted. That's not a compromise.
Right, but how could a community activist who's presumably seen poverty and the results of societal indifference, why would he be more interested in some abstract theory as of balancing the books and getting our fiscal house in order, which was the cliche we heard earlier, Why would he think that's more important than the lives of millions of Americans that is about to be impoverished?
Yeah, well, again, I think there are two plausible scenarios. One is that Obama has really bought into the Clinton line, and your guest also mentioned this, the belief that it was the Clinton budget surpluses that caused the economy to grow rapidly and that actually did reduce poverty rates a bit. We got the unemployment rate down almost to 1960s levels. Things looked pretty good. And they all claim that the causation goes that direction. It was the fiscal rectitude of Clinton that led to the good economy and allowed average Americans to have the first improvement in their standard of living since the 1960s. Okay, that's possible. And maybe even more probable than the other one, which is there was some sort of a Faustian bargain. It's very clear that Obama was the Wall Street candidate. He got the early Wall Street money.
So was Clinton, though, wasn't he?
That I'm not sure. But
well, he certainly had Rubin and company in there making these decisions that you're talking about, and he got rid of Glass-Steagall. So,
Right. No, he definitely brought all of Wall Street in to his administration.
Right.
That is true. Whether he got the early campaign money, I'm not sure. But
sure,
had Tom Ferguson on your show, and he is the expert on this.
Right.
And he called the election very early when everyone thought that Hillary was going to win. He said, no. Obama got the early Wall Street money. It will be the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there could have been a Faustian bargain. Okay, Obama, we are going to elect you, but here is your portfolio. You are going to do the job we've been trying to do since the Reagan years. We're going to kill the New Deal programs once and for all. We need to eliminate these programs in order to make America more competitive in the global economy. And it is plausible.
But let me just got to get this right in my own head because it doesn't make sense to me. How does it improve America's competitiveness if you have not just people, you know, destitute in the streets, but if you have uneducated people with no health care and no social security, what advantage is that? I don't understand what the advantage is, because one of the reasons that GM went broke was that they couldn't afford their health care costs, and they were shifting their plants to Canada where health care is covered by single payer. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think if we step back and take the bigger picture, you're absolutely right that what we need to do is to get rid of the private health care system and ramp up Medicare. So rather than shredding Medicare and Medicaid, what we need to do is get single payer like every other developed country in the world has, and that would make us more competitive.
But the Wall Street people are telling, according to your scenario, the Wall Street people are telling Obama, no, we just want to cut it all and cut those people loose so that we can compete with workers in Sri Lanka. Is that that's the compact?
And I think that to a great extent, a very large part of the American population and workforce are just seen as unnecessary. To globalized production.
Right, but they are necessary for consumption because, isn't this a consumer-driven economy? So, you know, I think we're going to have to have this conversation another time. Just as it's getting interesting, I'm afraid we're, you know, running out of time. But I just in closing, I recall Henry Ford's adage, and he was certainly no progressive. That you have to pay your workers enough that they can buy your products.
I know, and unfortunately, I think we've just lost that. I don't believe that that is the way our captains of industry view this anymore. They are looking to China. They are looking to Brazil. They believe that those are going to be the new markets. We don't need American consumers. We don't need an American middle class anymore. I hope I'm absolutely wrong on this. but it is looking more and more like this is the way that they view it. Why else do we have such an attack on the American middle class? If they had the Henry Ford view, they would not be trying to run our economy this way, and they wouldn't be trying to shred the safety nets.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, L. Randall Ray.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with L. Randall Ray, professor of economics and research director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He also writes regularly for the websites Benziger.com, New Economic Perspectives, and New Deal 2.0. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with an historian, the author of The Great Depression, America 1929 to 1941.